Welcome to the Amplifying Optimism in Education podcast, where we connect with educators from across the globe who are creating a better future for learning and educating now by implementing bold ideas and fostering a sense of curiosity, creativity, and possibility. We are here today with Laura Potter, who is at the University of Minnesota Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement. She also has a doctorate in educational psychology. Welcome to the podcast, Laura.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Wonderful, wonderful. And if you wouldn't mind just sharing a little bit about yourself for our listeners, yourself and your journey and your work.
Sure. So I am a school psychologist by training. I got my doctorate from the University of Minnesota that really trained me to be a great school psychologist working in schools and supporting students with disabilities, as well as students with potential suspected disabilities. And so I did that for the last 5 years. I was both a school psychologist and multi-tiered systems of support lead, MTSS lead, which really was about coordinating interventions for students who didn't have an identified disability. So I was doing that for a good 5 years in a large urban district in Minnesota here. And now, starting in June, which was a very odd time to switch jobs because it was June 2020, I switched jobs to work at the university where I'm doing more of similar work, working with MTSS, but supporting districts who are doing that work as opposed to being on the ground myself. And I really love my job. I'm thrilled to be working in that position, but I do really miss the kids. And I know a lot of kids are going back to school now, so it's sad to not be back there with them. So it's a little bit about me.
Yeah, thank you, Laura. And we know you have such a wealth of wisdom to offer, both from your experience and a lot of the work you've been doing, I guess, at the university since June.
Yes, yeah. A lot of what we've been working on is, so the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement, or CARI, as I'll refer to it, we do a lot of program evaluation with different organizations that are educational. And then we also do a big part of my job has been doing these MTSS or special education reviews with districts. During those, we look at a ton of data. We do some surveys. We've been doing online focus groups. Normally they'd be in person, but online focus groups, and just gathering a whole bunch of information and then turning that into some recommendations for how they can improve their systems.
Thank you.
I understand, Laura, that you have been involved in some research with some teachers, especially during this unusual time that we're in. We've been kind of plunged into the era of COVID. Everything changed, everything upended, instruction upended, some physical schools closed, some reopened and then closed down again, et cetera. Can you tell us a little bit about this survey that you've been involved in, and what was surprising or interesting about the findings?
Sure, absolutely, yeah. So my center, CARI, I'll give a little bit of history. So back in the summer, we conducted a survey with over 13,000 educators that really was about, as I was saying to you guys earlier, just what the heck just happened really in the spring of 2020. And they gave us a lot of really good insights. A lot of it was just about how stressed and worried educators were. Yeah. And so we worked with the Department of Education here in Minnesota to develop another kind of follow-up survey that's really about, okay, now that we're in a slightly different position in February of 2020, how are things going now? Asking similar questions about successes and challenges, supports that they needed. And so that was just administered across the state. Everyone in the state had an option to take it who was either any form of educator, including administrators, families of students, of any student in the pre-K through 12 system. as well as 6th through 12th grade students. They could complete the survey. We tried to make it very short, so it was no more than about 15 questions for each person, but tried to pack in all the information that we could get from there. So we're just now analyzing the results, so I apologize if I don't know exact responses, but I can share. We're writing them up right now, so I can share some of the things, like you were asking, Pamela, about what's surprising. One of the main things that came out was we asked people about the top three successes and the top three challenges that they'd been experiencing. And across all the different people who were responding, one of the top things that came out was mental health, either their own mental health, educators' mental health, their children's mental health, students identifying their own mental health. So across all levels, it was really just, I knew as a school psychologist by training, I knew that that would be huge, but it was number one for every group. So that was very surprising to me.
Very interesting. Thank you. You know, I'm just thinking about students too. You mentioned MTSS, you mentioned IEPs. What exactly has happened with some of these students? Have some of them fallen through the cracks, or have some of them risen to the challenge?
That's a very good question. It's interesting. I think this really reflects the challenges specifically of working with students with disabilities during a pandemic, is we asked one of the questions to go back to the survey was, which groups have you had the most difficulty supporting, just in terms of reaching them and being able to provide adequate supports? And which students have you had the most success with? What kind of subgroups have been maybe easier to access or support? And the top for both of those, both successes and challenges, was students with IEPs, so students who have identified disabilities. And that really both surprised me and didn't, because we're trying to meet their needs, and that's incredibly challenging. And also the paperwork aspect, I'll just throw out there, is really challenging to do. So there are a lot of protections, though, for students with disabilities that I can't say based on the survey results, or since I wasn't in schools, my own experience, but I think in part because they have those IEPs, I think they might've also been a little bit protected, because we legally have to have certain documentation. Legally, an evaluation has to be created every 3 years. Legally, the IEP team needs to meet every year. For the students that people were able to reach, my guess is that based on that response is that people were actually really successful at being able to meet some students' needs, but not all of them. So it's really hard to tell. I think it's just a really good depiction of how messy this year has looked, is that we've seen some great things with students with disabilities, but it's also been the hardest year ever for supporting them.
Yeah, I'm curious, as you talk about that, the notion that it's been both the greatest success and the greatest challenge, I'm wondering if there's a way, I know it's obviously a survey and it was a quick, you know, down and dirty survey, but I'm curious if there's any way for follow-up or for interaction between the respondents to just kind of get a sense of, well, what has been working that has made this such a success for the people that chose this as their greatest success? And on the opposite of that, what needs to be improved in order to meet the needs of those who are really struggling to have their needs met?
Yeah, we've talked about whether or not we actually would have the capacity to do some follow-up focus groups. That's what we'd love to do.
Yeah.
The issue is, we're honestly, with everything that I've been working on, and every educator can attest to this, everybody's exhausted right now.
Right.
And so asking for that kind of feedback might need to wait a little bit, because we just want to give them a break. But you're absolutely right. That's something that we need to dig further into. With this very brief survey, it just kind of pointed us in a direction, and we need to kind of delve further into those directions that it was pointed. So,
yeah, I think it's important as we come out of this moment that we're in with COVID is to really you know, we talk about taking this pause, right? And where are we, and kind of seeing what has actually happened over the past year, and where are we able to really grow, and where are we able to really say, you know what, that wasn't working pre-COVID, let's not go back to that, let's move forward. And so I'm curious, what are your thoughts just in general, both as you're seeing the respondents' answers, as well as you're having this experience yourself being previously in the schools and now talking to people who are in the schools?
Yeah, I think the main thing that I've heard from people, and this is probably echoed nationwide, is like grateful, people are grateful that they've developed such great technology skills now. And they never would have developed understanding of those platforms. I had colleagues who were refusing to use Google Docs at all before this, not just for their students, but in general. So they've had to just really quickly adapt a learning curve. And I think it will pay off in the long run, just their ability to be that flexible and use all those different services. I also think that the main thing that came out when I was working in schools in the spring, the thing that I heard loud and clear was this really gave a spotlight on the inequity that happens in schools and just the inequitable practices for so many different reasons.
Yes.
Based on race, based on income, based on first language that people speak, all of the just different ways that we reach out to families was just amped up in terms of the discrepancies that we saw. And then as you mentioned, I'm in Minneapolis where George Floyd was killed. And that just really, man, it was at the very end of the school year, and our ability to just fully even grasp, myself as a white woman, to really grasp what our students were going through in response to that was just mind-boggling. It still is. Like, it's, I think just the whole theme of last spring was like, wow, these inequities have existed for a long time, and wow, we haven't dealt with them, and we really need to.
Yeah, and I'm intrigued, you know, kind of if you could put your school psychologist hat on for a moment here, just kind of think about, you know, if the number one need across the board, as you said, between parents and students and staff and teachers and is mental health support, it's not something like, that's not something you can just be like, okay, well, when we're back in person, we'll try to address that. So I'm curious, how do you try to address that in this moment, online, virtually, or in some kind of hybrid model, to really start trying to meet those needs now before it is too late for a large population that's asking for this need?
Yeah, that's a great question. What we did in the spring of 2020, which again, I feel like we were just infants in this whole process, right, of learning about distance, yes, learning, we just did our best. As I was the lead of my mental health team at my school, in a middle school, and we, granted it was middle schoolers who don't want to be seen on video at any time, or talk on the phone really, or have themselves called out in any way. Yes. But we did get them, I think I spoke about this a little bit in Pamela's book, about the fact that when we just put our information out there, myself and the counselors, we didn't really get a lot of students reaching out, but once we turned it into a very easy to click Google form, then students were much more willing to reach out. Even when they did fill that out, and I would set up Google Meets, sometimes they would show up, sometimes they wouldn't, that was fine. They very rarely showed their face in the video, also fine. But just a lot of kind of reluctance about this new medium of connecting with somebody that they used to stop by my office every day, multiple times. So it wasn't necessarily our relationship that was the issue, it was the medium and how comfortable they felt kind of reaching out in that way. My colleagues who are still in schools now say that that's gotten a little bit better. Students have gotten a little bit more comfortable with online counseling or online just connections. But I'll be totally honest that we just all need to be back in person. I know there's definitely ways to do it remotely. But especially with, I'm thinking about my middle schoolers in particular, just the access of them having a date on their calendar that they can meet and like remembering, it takes a parent to remind them often or a family member to remind them. So having that executive functioning skills to really make an appointment and keep that appointment has been really challenging. Minnesota right now is transitioning back to all students having at least hybrid learning as a state. And my friends who are working in the schools now are just saying it's the students who are coming to school are showing up with needs that even if they had been talking to them on the phone or via Google Meet, the needs are far beyond what they had expected. Where they'll learn something new, like, oh, this student actually lost both of their grandparents and their aunt to COVID. And I'll be honest that's just better dealt with in person, just having that conversation and the body language that they can see and making sure that they know where to go to get that support, where somebody's office is or how to access that help is just a lot easier when it's a physical space that you can go to. So I hate that answer because I would love to say that we can address a lot of the mental health needs now. I think some of it will just inevitably come out more once we're in person. I also think students are going to open up more just in terms of sharing information once they're in person.
Screen time is such an interesting thing, and it's you know, there's been studies about the brain and how, you know, sitting in a Zoom meeting like this and our attention is in a different way than when we're in person. Does your group and your team, you know, think about screen time and what it means? And I think we're going to continue to have screen time for a while, but hopefully, like you said, in person. Is it something that is part of your group's thinking about?
At Cary, we don't necessarily address screen time directly, but it's more about, at least from the research that I've read, especially for really young kids, it's more about like, what are they not doing because they're on a screen? And so if they're not playing outside because they're on a screen, or if they're not interacting with an adult or a peer because they're on a screen, that's really where you see some of the challenges. And I think that's highlighted in this pandemic is they're not, I just saw a report about secondary students and just their huge decrease in fitness levels of just like nobody's moving. And that's problematic. So it's also just exhausting. So we don't specifically investigate screen time, but we're focused more on just like, we're actually trying to get kids on screens, to be totally honest, because of student engagement levels. If they're in distance learning, we're trying to get them there and actually interacting, but trying to make that as human as possible. So trying to increase the synchronous learning time as opposed to asynchronous, that's been a big push in the state and a requirement in the state to have at least some synchronous learning time. So it's less about the fact that it's on a screen and more about the fact that they might be missing out on relationship building or any of those other things that make us human.
Yes. I think you had mentioned something about what you called rapid briefs that were done. And I wanted to hear more about what rapid briefs were and what kind of things you found that were worthy of a rapid brief.
Sure. Yeah. So through my organization, like I said, we partner a lot with our State Department of Education. And one of the things that we discovered as a need was in that previous survey I mentioned in the summer of 2020, one of the biggest needs that came out was people were wondering, how the heck do we assess students during this crazy time? How do we know? And that's not just the formal state assessments. People aren't wondering about that so much as how do I, for next year, have an incoming second grader and I don't know anything about their ability to read? How do we assess that? How do I figure out where they're at so I can make my teaching and my instruction fit their levels? And so that was a question that was, that came up in the survey that we did over the summer. And so that led to us developing these rapid briefs specifically that are just short, about 3 to 5 page documents that are just guidance documents. And they're all about assessment. And the topics that we surveyed people about and that came up as kind of the highest need were, we developed one that was just assessment guidance in general. There was about 30 different documents that we found online throughout the nation of just guidance, where we tried to summarize that guidance and say, okay, here's these 30 different documents of what people are saying right now. Let's hone it in on what to do right now. And some of that guidance was like, just don't change how you're assessing this year just because it's a pandemic. So don't buy a whole new testing system for this year. Stick with what you traditionally do and try to do what you can. So that was one of the topics, what we're working on right now. And I'm pretty excited about one of the biggest needs that came up was about grading. Like, how the heck do you grade during this time? And thankfully, I have colleagues who know more about grading than I do. As a school psychologist, I'm trained in assessment, but less on specific standards in grading. So they're helping to develop that guidance. But the one that I'm most excited about is about retention. And something that we've been hearing from all of our colleagues in schools, as well as from the State Department of Education, is everybody's asking, should we retain our students because they didn't really get as high quality of an education as we would have wanted this year? And the research on retention, I don't know if you all are familiar with it, but it is very clearly says no. Regardless of what's happening with COVID right now, which is a whole other issue of the context where, guess what, everybody did not get as high quality of an education as they had hoped this year. The research says it's just hugely detrimental. Students do not actually gain any extra skills by being in the same grade again, by being held back a year. And social and emotionally, it's such a big detriment that even if they were to gain some skills during that time, it's not worth it. They withdraw. It's at any grade level. It's just a really negative impact. It's actively, there was a quote that I was just reading that was like, it's very rare that we know something for sure in education is detrimental to students, and retention, grade level retention is that. It's very, it's not helpful. And then in the context of COVID, it doesn't make any sense because everybody's in the same boat. So that's some of the stuff that we're highlighting, just primarily for educational leaders. We're trying to highlight it for them and then hoping that they'll pass on the information to families on down. I know that the Department of Education is also working on trying to get some of that information directly out to families as well, just saying, no, don't just hold back your student. We're all getting through this together right now.
Yeah, there is kind of this aspect of, in this moment, if we think about what is most important, you know, it's not the standards necessarily. It's not, did they meet the standards of whatever grade they were in, so that we can say technically we feel comfortable moving them on to the next grade level? Because what are standards in the midst of all this, where the learning is happening in so many different ways and so many different venues that and in areas that have nothing to do with the school? You know, and so what students are learning now is very valuable, but it's not being captured in any state standards, right? So I'm curious what you're noticing about that and what your experience has been with that as well.
It's really interesting. On the most recent survey that we did, we asked just generally, like I said, we tried to make it short, but just generally about learning and the extent to which people felt like they or their students were learning. Most people, we only had three options. It was like learning a little, learning, not learning at all, learning a little, learning some, and learning a lot. And most people actually answered learning some. So it's not a complete loss. There was a lot of people who answered learning some in early childhood and also the younger grades, where kids tended to be in school a little bit more here in Minnesota. People, even a significant portion, answered learning a lot. Which was kind of surprising. But what we learned from just doing this process of asking that question is we do need to get a little bit more fine-grained and ask, what about social emotional learning, technological learning? So any of those 21st century skills really that you need, so academic learning, but just all those different areas, and maybe asking about like, what did they learn about themselves and their own resilience? So there's a lot of questions to ask about. I love what you were saying, Josh, like to ask about what did kids learn? They learned quite a bit this year. Was it the traditional standards that we're hoping that they can meet by different grade levels? Maybe not, but maybe so. I do think that some students have also, I'm sure you guys have come across this, a decent amount of students, I can't estimate what percent, but have really preferred the online learning environment and might stick with it.
Yes.
So I think there's a lot of either introverted or just people with unique learning preferences who are saying, you know, I like this. I want to stick with online learning as much as possible. And they are actually addressing the learning standards that they were supposed to meet because they're interacting with the content that their educators are putting out.
There's also an aspect too, like you're saying, around like culturally responsive teaching as well, where you talked about being in Minnesota and having to think about the murder of George Floyd and what that impact was on students, and how do you address that with your students, knowing that this is something they experienced very viscerally, probably being in proximity, as well as just understanding what's happening in the greater context of the country. And so I think that, you know, I often say we're dealing with the two pandemics. It's not just COVID. We have racism in America that we've been working and figuring out as well. And so that has to, I also think, be addressed in our schools as we come out of this as well. And so I'm curious, you know, if you've done any survey questions around that, or if there's any aspect of the culturally responsive aspects too.
That's a great question. Our questions didn't really address that, but I'm just thinking of how to respond. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's been a huge call nationwide and worldwide, to be honest, but in Minnesota, to just like, enough is enough. It's time. That either as an individual, if your district's not on board, or as a school, or as a whole district, or as a whole state, we really need to address racial equity in our school systems. Minnesota, unfortunately, has some of, there are some great things about Minnesota, but our inequities in either housing or jobs, and also within education, are some of the highest in the country. So meaning that we have some students who are very high performing that bring all of our state test scores up. But then that just means there's even higher discrepancy between the students who are performing at a lower level in terms of academics. So I think this has really shown a spotlight the experience of going through being in a school in the spring. It was just, as a white woman, maybe more so than it should have been, it was incredibly eye-opening to me, just the inequities that had been present in our school in terms of our student access to different resources throughout the community. That inequity already existed. I, as a white person, saw a spotlight shone on it for the first time. That was really as bright as it was. And it made me realize that I need to kick it into high gear. So I thought I was kind of I thought I was a progressive white person, and I was not doing enough. And so I think that's been pretty much all of my colleagues have echoed similar things, that especially that educators are often people who look like me. And I feel like we're just trying to figure out how to do this. We recognize that it's, as you said, a pandemic, that it's an epidemic, that it is something that is an emergency. And to me, that's a huge awakening, and it's a start to launch everything where, even though our survey questions didn't address that specifically, the work that we're doing as a center, we actually, I think like a lot of organizations, like started to really have specific equity conversations on a regular basis. How can we integrate equity work into everything that we're doing, from program evaluation to consulting with districts? So I'm just kind of going off on everything that has been going on in my world in terms of racial equity and the fact that things desperately need to change, but I still feel like we're in the process of figuring out what needs to change and how quickly, how we can quickly address the huge issues that are happening in the large systems in Minnesota.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, again, I where you are, right? So you're at an applied research, so you can do the research and begin to think about how do we apply it. And I love the second part of the title of your organization, of educational improvement, right? So how do you, as you said, how do we get to the questions that are actually addressing some of these issues? And then how do we, you know, do the briefs and do the recommendations and do the work that allows the systems to change? And so I don't know if you guys, you said you've been having these types of conversations. I'm curious what that looks like. And if you've had, I'm sure there's been thoughts around this, but I'm just curious what those are and how do you go from that applied research to the actual improvement in education?
Yeah. So I've actually been leading, I know it's a little cheesy because I think everybody's doing a book study right now, but we've been doing a book study. First we read How to Be an Anti-Racist. Now we're reading the Bettina Love book, We Want to Do More Than Survive. And they're both wonderful. So those have really just been guiding our conversations though. What we're working on now is trying to take a look at every aspect of what we do as an organization internally and externally. And identify specific action items within that. So a good example of something that we've been talking about is we often develop these, whenever we're starting a project, we develop a proposal for it. So having a checklist during our proposal development, where we're actually having the budget and everything laid out in the proposal, where we actually have a checklist that we review to make sure that we're integrating equity into our work. So that's making sure that we have student and parent voice somewhere in the report. Like previous to this, we didn't necessarily survey or ask students or families about the special education services in their district. That's a huge missing piece. And so just making sure that we have I'm kind of a nerd for processes and linear processes. So we're trying to just make this, build it into our organization of here's a checklist that you always have to go through whenever you're writing a proposal to make sure that we actually we allocate adequate funding to make this an equitable look at what the issue is that this group is asking us to look at. So I think that's a start, but also just in our hiring practices as well. We're primarily a white organization. So internally, we need to look at how we're recruiting people, how the university is recruiting people, and just what our efforts look like. So it's kind of at each level have been our conversations that have been guided by kind of that background reading as well.
Yeah, I think that's really important work to be doing. And I'm intrigued as to how, as you do that work and as you move through it, what the impact will be for the students who are you are doing the research for and trying to figure out how do we then improve the systems. And so I'm just curious your thoughts as to what that could look like and what the goal is for the students as you move forward with the research here.
I mean, the goal is just educational improvement. I mean, honestly, some of the districts that we have worked with or are working with have huge discrepancies in, for example, physical restraints of Black boys versus other students. And that's something that we need to be we can't just ask teachers about because they have a certain perspective that is very valid, but we need to hear from the families' experiences and the students' experiences of that as well. And so actually, I think a lot of what we're trying to do is just make sure that the voices are there, because when we at least present that, we're evaluators, and so we're not politicians or anything, we're not trying to sway anybody in a certain direction, but we want to make sure that we have the data to demonstrate if there's actually a need and how a district can improve upon that need. So the goal, I mean, in that specific instance would to be A, to just reduce physical holds in general, but specifically, and that's often for students with disabilities, but specifically to just make sure that it's not predictable by somebody's race, what their educational outcomes would be. So that's a long-term goal that Minnesota has a long way to come, but we're moving.
I just have a general question for you as a school psychologist, as a researcher right now. What are you hopeful about educationally?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think it's really easy to get bogged down in the negative in education, especially right now with just how exhausting everything is. That is a great question. I actually am hopeful about this. Even though this pandemic has been horrible for people's mental health, I'm hopeful that maybe this would mean that we actually fund mental health supports for students and for families appropriately and adequately in schools. I oftentimes, as a school psychologist, was in three or four different schools. Thankfully, towards the last few years, I was just in one because they bought up my time. But oftentimes school nurses, for example, there's not just any of those support staff that often end up supporting those students in their mental health challenges. There's not enough of us. We know what to do, but we're bogged down by having too many students with too many needs. So that would be a huge hope of mine, that we would actually take these data from surveys like ours and just in general and say, oh, maybe we should adequately support students' social, emotional, and mental health while they're in school. It could be through health insurance, but that's a whole other complicated topic right there. So, that would be kind of my biggest hope, would be pointing to, like, shining the spotlight and hoping that that also means more resources allocated towards mental health.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's such a great question, Pam, and great questions, Josh and Pam and Laura. I mean, I feel very, even though we were discussing complex topics, the clarity of the data-driven thoughtfulness of your work is really something that I think is refreshing. And, you know, for many of our listeners in schools who are leading schools, they might, you know, be aware of a lot of the information that you shared, but I think that you provided some nice context and just a lot more dimension to what folks are kind of wrestling with still now in schools. So thank you so much for joining us today. Is there any last words that you might have, or anything you want our listeners to know about in terms of where they can find you or some of your work or things like that?
Sure. Yeah, I don't have any kind of, that was, Pamela's question was so great about the hope. So I'll leave you with that. But
I like that. We'll leave it with hope.
If anybody is interested in either the report that we produced over the summer about the distance learning survey is what it was called, or we'll soon, I think in early April, we'll be producing the report that summarizes the results of this current survey. Mm-hmm. That is going to be found on our website, which is, if you just Google the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement, that'll come up, or CAREI, CAREI, that'll come up. It's not an easy website to rattle off.
Well, we'll put it also, I'll make sure we've got the right link and we'll put it in the show notes too for folks to grab.
But yeah, I'm really excited. I'll also note that we are going to be doing this survey or a version of it two more times. So we're going to be administering it in June and then probably in about October next school year. So we're trying to look at longitudinal trends over time, and hopefully some of these needs related to mental health, other things, hopefully some of those needs will be met by the time that we do some of our next surveys. So. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I saw Pam making notes when you said those months, so I imagine we'll follow up to sort of hear your longitudinal findings if you'll be willing to share them. That's so exciting.
Absolutely.
Good to know that someone's studying that.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. All righty. Well, thank you again, Laura.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. Thank you all. It's great to meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Josh and I hope you enjoyed listening to this week's episode of Amplifying Optimism in Education. Please join us next week for another new episode and conversation with an innovative educator from around the world.